by a gentleman named Mr. Tonkin. They opposed our application for a certificate of public convenience and necessity before the Federal Power Commission. I felt that their opposition was unfair, particularly during wartime, so I went to see an old friend, Nelson Rockefeller, whom I knew years ago in North Tarrytown, and I asked Nelson if he wouldn't speak to Mr. Tonkin and ask him to withdraw his opposition to us merely during the time of war when all Americans should join forces. At the conclusion of the war, why, we could resolve our respective differences, because the Hope Natural Gas Company was a big company and Tennessee Gas and Transmission Company was a very small one, of which I was the head. Well, Nelson told me, he said, well, Kurt, he said, I haven't got anything to do with the oil business anymore. I'm the coordinator of Latin American affairs. I said, yes, I know you haven't got much to do with the oil business, Nelson, you and your family, you just control it. Now let's get down to business. I said, please, let's cooperate during the wartime. So he said, okay, Kurt. He said, okay. He said, you send a telegram to Mr. Tonkin to collaborate during the wartime. And I think that's a good suggestion. I said, thanks very much, Nelson. Best regards to you. And I went away. I sent Mr. Tonkin a wire that afternoon, and he replied the next morning with a very testy wire to me, I am not interested, quote, I am not interested in saving critical war materials, period. Well, in 30 days, Mr. Tonkin was no longer president of the Hope Natural Gas Company, and Tennessee Gas and Transmission Company sailed ahead, and we got our certificate. Dr. Beter, how do you like that one?
Well, that's very good news. How would you like this? Now, the Rockefeller interests and their associates now control that very company. So you were working, in effect, for Nelson Rockefeller, because even though
controlling what company?
Tenneco Company. My point is that Nelson Rockefeller said, okay, let you go ahead and do this, and then here they are benefiting, what I'm saying, from your early activities.
That's quite possible, Dr. Beter.
So they win, whichever way the ball balances.
All right, let me ask you a question, Dr. Beter. How many times do you see the Standard Oil Group lose?
I've seen them lose once.
When was that?
And yet the show is still going on. That's with Sohio, the Standard Oil Company of Ohio, under which BP, British Petroleum, has taken a 25% interest. And if this interest will increase to 52% based upon the amount of oil that is going to be pumped through the Alaskan pipeline, but I assure you that Alaskan pipeline will rarely, if ever, carry oil because of the coming world war. So I think in the end, the Rockefellers may win this also and prevent British Petroleum from taking a controlling interest in Standard Oil of Ohio.
Dr. Beter, do you think there's a coming war?
There's no doubt about it. This is their scenario, and we will go into that later on.
I'll be very interested to talk to you more on that point.
Right. Now, having related that, we're now going overseas, and you must have had occasion that sometimes carrying secret letters or getting in contact with your old friend FDR and have long talks. Could you tell us anything about that?
Well, I think you refer to a situation there which I might briefly comment upon. I was ordered to go overseas to join the 12th Air Force in World War II, and I had said goodbye to the family and friends and had my bags packed, and I stopped by the White House by appointment, of course, to say hello to the president and pay my respects and say goodbye, because we were always very friendly. And I might say, Dr. Beter, that I was one of his mother's three trustees, so it should have been very friendly. So she did not want to have me disturbed as one of her three trustees, even though I was not technically in the family, which I regard as a very great compliment coming from Sarah Delano Roosevelt. So I stopped in there, and we had a very nice chat. And he seemed to want to talk longer and longer, and I noticed out in the hall There was about 15 or 20 people waiting to see him. People would come in, open the door to see if everything was going on, and he'd wave them out. And he and I still kept talking there. And he said, I would like to have you deliver a letter to my son, Elliot. I said, I'd be delighted to, Mr. President, as I was very formal. And so he wrote and wrote and wrote. And heads would pop in the door, and finally he gave me this letter. I said, I'd be delighted to deliver it to him personally when I get there. Well, strangely enough, late that afternoon, I don't know what happened. I never did. But I know my immediate boss in the Pentagon was very annoyed. But orders came back from the 12th Air Force to not have me come there. Now, whether Elliot had anything to do with it, I do not know. I simply know that my orders were canceled and I remained in the Pentagon. So I was forced to return this very personal letter to the president by special messenger, and I don't know what happened, but it must have been very embarrassing to him.
One of the most significant moments of my life, Colonel, was Pearl Harbor. I remember exactly where I was in Detroit having dinner with friends of mine. Where were you when Pearl Harbor happened?
I was in Washington, D.C., I believe.
Do you recall how you felt when you first heard it?
Well, I was flabbergasted and couldn't imagine how a situation like that could have happened unbeknownst to the commanders in charge with reporting the advance of the Japanese task force. I never could understand it until at a later date. If you'd like to have me tell you about that, I'd be delighted to do it.
I do, because I remember very well reading your book, The Warlords of Washington, which contained the secrets of Pearl Harbor. And I wish you would give your impressions around the White House as it existed at that time and subsequent thereto.
Dr. Beter, I may be accused of being abrasive, but when I first heard about the real inside story of this thing, I nearly fell on the floor and bumped my head, and it took me about 2 years to get over the effects of it. It was so devastating. There is no doubt in my mind but that the big internationalist powers wanted to get us into World War II in the worst way. Germany would not fall for a second repeat of World War I, and they were staying aloof. So therefore, FDR and Mr. Baruch, Mr. Frankfurter, and some of the other boys in the hierarchy had to figure out how America could become involved. And so they went via the tripartite treaty with Japan, Italy, and Germany, whereby if any one of those powers were attacked, the others would have to join forces. So the Secretary of War, Stimson, concocted the plan with FDR and others to lure the Japanese task force to attack Pearl Harbor on a specific time. The Japanese task force, according to what Admiral Kimmel told me several years later, right out of his mouth, and he and I became friendly before he died. He said if the Japanese task force had had advance information that the American forces at Pearl Harbor were alerted, they had specific instructions, Dr. Beter, to return to safe waters. So therefore, certain interests on a Saturday night brought all the defenses around Honolulu and Pearl Harbor in for Saturday night parties and what have you. Some of the carriers were sent away. And on Sunday morning, the Holocaust occurred. Admiral Kimmel knew nothing about it, neither did General Shaw. Admiral told me that he got the message from General Marshall at 2 o'clock in the afternoon to be alerted. When the bombs started to fall on Pearl Harbor at 7 a.m. that morning. And the whole thing is one of the most horrendous examples of perfidy that I have even ever read about or can envision. As I said, it took me about 2 years to get over it. Now, you've asked me some very pertinent questions. Yes, I think the president and his group around him, including General Marshall, whom I regard as a sort of a traitor. They knew about when this attack was going to happen because FDR had insulted the Japanese. They didn't know exactly to the minute, but the attack from the Japanese was imminent. And when General Marshall went to see Admiral Stark early on the morning of November 7th, 1942, Admiral Stark says, "General, this means war. Let us immediately warn General Short and Admiral Kimmel over our new radio. It's pretty fast. We can get that news out there in a half an hour." General Marshall was reported to have said, "Don't do that. Leave it to me. I will advise them." He did so. And Admiral Kimmel told me he got a wire by Western Union that reached him at 2 o'clock in the afternoon when the bombs started to fall at 7 a.m. this morning. Dr. Beter, how do you like that? I think that's simply incredible to me to understand.
This is what I can't understand, Colonel. I remember very well, and I heard it on the radio several times back in 1940, and I want to quote, "And while I am talking to you mothers and fathers, I give you one more assurance. I have said this before, and I shall say it again and again and again. Your boys are not going to be sent into any foreign wars." Unquote. That was President Franklin Delano Roosevelt in his campaign speech in Boston on the eve of the 1940 election. Now, remember, he said, "Your boys are not going to be sent into any foreign wars." What do you say, Colonel Dow?
What do I say? I would say that that statement was a deceitful one. I would say that the catchword in there is the word foreign. Pearl Harbor is not foreign. It's part of the U.S., and I think it's part of the plan to involve us into World War largely to serve the best interests of international bankers and the Communist Party.
Getting back to the sources that you mentioned, this personal primary evidence, I have also primary evidence to the effect that Pearl Harbor was left defenseless and that the people in charge there after it occurred, those who survived, literally cried on the shoulders of doctors who treated them, and they kept asking why, and many of these people were broken and disheartened, and some of them even committed suicide.
Well, Dr. Beter, it's a very tragic subject. I would say that the forces at Pearl Harbor were not rendered defenseless. I would say basically they were not duly alerted. Most of the important carriers and other important vehicles had been deliberately removed. But the factor of surprise on the early Sunday morning attack by the Japanese was what they counted on, and they caught everybody unaware because nobody suspected anything of it.
I have before me an article by Colin Cross of the London Observer, and he wrote last January from London, quote, "President Franklin D. Roosevelt was so eager to get Americans into World War II in 1941 that he went out of his way to provoke incidents which could be represented as German aggression against America, according to British documents now declassified. The documents also show at least that this was what Roosevelt was telling British Prime Minister Winston Churchill in the summer and autumn of that year. This is revealed in secret wartime British cabinet documents for 1941-1945. Continuing to quote, Colonel, Roosevelt was obviously determined to come into the war, Churchill said. If he were to put the issue of peace or war to Congress, they would debate it for 3 months. The president, the president had said that he would wage war but not declare it, and that he would become more and more provocative. If the Germans did not like it, they could attack the American forces.
That's exactly what Roosevelt did.
He waged war,
but did not declare it.
So, Colonel, Pearl Harbor hastened our entry into the Second World War. And could you tell us whether or not there were any acts which could have hastened peace?
Dr. Beter, I recall one particular cogent incident which could have shortened World War II by 17 months and saved thousands and thousands of lives and enormous treasure and suffering. George Earle was a governor of Pennsylvania for a long time, and he was a close friend of FDR at Harvard. His nephew discussed with me some time ago that I should call on George Earle and talk to him about his office over there in the Near East, where Roosevelt appointed him as a special minister. I did so, and after several hours, I came away with an ear-popping story, because George Earle was approached by Admiral Canaris of the German Secret Service to say that if America would drop the very abrasive policy of unconditional surrender as put forward by some of our internationalists, that the German people would like to get out from under the reign of Adolf Hitler. And if assurances could be given to him that a less than unconditional surrender could be obtained from Washington, forces were then in action to eliminate Adolf Hitler. George Earle contacted Washington unsuccessfully several times. Finally, he got a reply to take this up with the field commander in Europe, which is, of course, perfectly absurd in view of a matter of this gravity. The field commander at that time was General Dwight Eisenhower, and Dwight Eisenhower didn't know any more than a general would know about the high-level diplomatic phases of which Admiral Canaris had approached George Earle. Nothing happened, to the regret of George Earle, and he came back to Washington expressing great indignation. FDR said, well, if you're going to feel that way and talk about it, I'm going to send you to Samoa, which he did at the close of World War II. And George Earle spent the remaining months in Samoa when he was a very, very erudite and very informed minister. So you can see that the forces in Washington did not want to foreclose World War II until the German people had been exhausted, which is a very, very tragic mistake.
Well, Colonel, that was as far as Germany was concerned. How about Japan?
Well, I think it's very well known, Dr. Beter, that Japan, several months prior to the close of the war, tried to negotiate a surrender program, but the powers that be here in Washington did not want that to happen at the time until they would be able to demonstrate the power and destruction of the atomic bomb, which was demonstrated to the horror of many people throughout the world in Japan. Japan was ready to surrender months before the bombing of Hiroshima.
Of course, you know, our experience has shown that certain people do believe that war does alter the structure of life of a nation. Many people cannot believe that peace to these people really means war and complete control over the lives and properties of a nation. Do you believe that this philosophy could have come into it at that time?
Well, I certainly do, Dr. Beter, because war is a policy of international bankers and their conniving policies. War makes possible for bankers on both sides to reap huge profits.
I remember during the Second World War, Colonel, that I had a feeling that under FDR, the country, especially in the third and fourth term of his office, was going down toward a collectivist society.
Well, you use the word collectivism. I got this feeling that his experiments in socialism and freewheeling, you might say, from a federal government point of view, had about reached its end, and therefore the powers that be felt that war would be necessary to substantiate a lot of their principles. So we were pushed into World War II. And as you know, wars upset the economic balance. They do a lot of damage to our financial setup, but that's all duly planned for ahead of time, and it generally works out to the profit from international bankers, Dr. Beter, on both sides. Well, that's very hard for the public to understand, but that's what I think.
Being from Wall Street, Colonel, you have heard many stories about the Russian Revolution being supported by Wall Street. In your opinion, how was this brought about?
Well, it wasn't supported by Wall Street in toto. It was supported by certain elements in Wall Street, Dr. Beter, to be specific. And those elements had been there for some time, and it was the internationalist elements in Wall Street that wanted to overthrow the Tsarist regime. And that was for 100 years that objective had been in mind of the powerful banking interests of Europe headed by the Rothschilds. Now, various people had come to this country in our banking setup and were in Wall Street, notably in the firms of Kuhn Loeb, Spire, Ladenburg Thalmann, and one or two others, notably Kuhn Loeb. And Jacob Schiff was one of the leaders in raising money, important financing, to aid the Bolshevik Revolution in early 1917. Now, the Bolshevik Revolution was changed to be called the Communist Revolution later on, because the word Bolshevik or Bolshevism was a very ugly, unacceptable word, and it helped to mislead the American public. So Jacob Schiff is one of the leaders there, and he had others that helped him, of course, and substantial money went over to the Soviets in the early part of 1917. Well, we were deeply involved in war. That's part of the technique. This was done while the United States was fighting a war.
Well, weren't the Rockefellers at that time using these same bankers as their merchant banks, also their investment bankers?
Well, I think the Rockefellers used a good many banks, including the Morgan Interest and
yes,
others there. So I wouldn't point my finger at the at that one bank. I think the Rockefeller interests were pretty well spread about Wall Street.
Yes, and these same type of people, weren't they also influential in bringing in 1913 the Federal Reserve system?
Well, the same crowd, absolutely. They were the father and the mother of the Federal Reserve system, you might say.
We're on the verge of another war, another Third World War, and the forces are now gathering to make us complete slaves. Is there anything that that can stop these people from bringing about this war? I know that from our efforts and our talks around the country that we've been getting the questions of what we can do to try to stop this war. And as you know, I've been giving advice as to what people can do to help themselves and to help this country. But to try to stop this war that is coming, this will be the third world war. This will be their third major attempt to subjugate us and to put us under their dictatorial regime, under a one-world regime, if you please, whether it be the Soviets or the Rockefeller-controlled government here. What would you have to say at this time to your listeners if you were in a position to help?
Dr. Beter, that's a big question, and I really realize that you know a great deal more about it than I do. I have some feelings, though, that I can express or answer your question as I sit here as a law-abiding, loyal American citizen. I think you have to realize that the major foment that we're subjected to is to establish a dictatorial one-world government and have a group of people in the know, in the control there, control all of the money of the world and the economic markets in respect thereto. That's what I think.
Colonel, the Rockefeller dynasty, the Roosevelt dynasty, both of these dynasties have benefited from everything here in America. Why do they continually go forward with their alliances with Soviet Russia?
Well, Dr. Beda, that's a difficult question, but a very interesting one, and a great many people ask the same question to me. The best answer I can give to you, and I think it's an accurate answer, is along these lines. The few outstanding leaders of great wealth, super rich, we might describe them, can be called corporate socialists, as contrasted with communism, which is state socialism, and which caters to the so-called proletariat. There is absolutely no difference between corporate socialism and state socialism, except the identity of those which control each group respectively. The communist has no more idea, the average communist has no more idea of the fact that great wealth supports the communist movement of which he's a part. He's supposed to fight the wealthy and supposed to fight capitalism as his arch enemy. It is ironical to realize that they finance to a large extent the movements of these state socialists. And you might say, why do they do this? The answer is, when you have a lot of money, most people want to get more. If you're greedy to start with, you become more greedy. And soon the geographical limits of a country vanish, and a man begins to think on an international plane. The super rich group in this corporate state, the corporate socialists, they want profits. They want increased profits. They want increased markets. They want increased control of the world's money supply. The whole communist setup in Soviet Russia is an experiment by the super rich to move world socialism along. And therefore, my answer to you is that if the American people understood what motivated our communist program in our State Department, there would be a revolution of some sort. Now, maybe Thomas Jefferson is right when he said that there should be a revolution every 30 or 60 days if our government got out of hand here. It seems to me that our government is out of hand here in this country because it's overly influenced by the corporate socialists in New York and in the capital centers of the world. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does, Colonel Dowell. I want to thank you very much for appearing with us here today and informing the American people, making them aware of the dangers that are facing them. And I look forward to another serious discussion with you. And on behalf of our listeners, may I say God bless you and keep you forever.
Thank you, Dr. Beda. It's been a pleasure to be with you. And I hope that the American people, in listening to our frank exchange here tonight, will get some ideas whereby we can save our country and the fine heritage which we have had handed to us from our forebears.